Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 303rd episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K Barton Tools, and I'm here with my co-host, Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop and Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. Today, we're visiting with Ethan Sincox, an outstanding hand tool woodworker, contributor to Quercus.
Yeah,
I know
Latin
it's
old,
but I've never heard that pronounced before. A magazine and a kilt.
Well, aren't we all?
Aren't we all?
I mean, I yes. appreciate it.
So, anyway, sorry about butchering the name of the magazine there, but
that's all right.
I've seen it in all over Instagram and wherever, and ordered my copy earlier this week, so I can't wait to get it. But I never heard that pronounced, but I did notice it's what, like a genus name of oak or something like that.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, cool. Before we get into talking with Ethan, let's talk about some points of interest in the woodworking community since we last spoke. So I guess I'll start off. Julio Vargas, I think where I stole my what I call the template turning on the lathe to do angles and straight tenons for Windsor chairs. Well, if y'all may remember, I actually stole that idea from Julio, who posted some stuff that he was doing on turning. And he just did another thing using kind of the same jig, but actually to turn a sphere. It's pretty fascinating. So basically, he has the jig, and instead of it following a template, he's just got it on a pivot point. So the whole thing pivots around to actually turn a sphere. So it's pretty cool. So I thought I'd give him a shout out about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that. Now, like you kind of had mentioned before on your version of it, you're rough turning it down close to and then using this only at the final pass.
Yeah.
He looked like in the one video, he was adjusting it, but he like gouged in a depth that he wanted to hit in the center. And then that pin, he was like swinging that pin around and then around. But it looked like he did a whole lot of roughing to get it to close to that to begin with.
I think
similar fashion. But then, that step of like advance until you kiss it kind of.
Yeah, and I think he's doing it. The reason I have mine so locked down is because I wanted one, the tower that holds the tool in it. Mm-hmm. I wanted that tower to be able to do both straight tenons and tapered tenons.
So offset system, right?
Yeah. So that tool can't move. It's got to be locked in there. But I think what he's doing is he's advancing the tool a little bit. But it's pretty cool. And somebody, I thought it was in my DMs, but I checked my DMs and I didn't find it. But somebody reached out to me with this exact idea. He goes, "Hey, could you use this to turn spheres?" And I'm just like, "Oh, Julio just did it." So, and I tried to find that DM or comment, but I couldn't. But anyway, so hopefully
for anybody who's tried to turn a sphere, I've tried it on a very small, like an inch ball,
which sound harder than a big sphere.
It may be, but no matter what, it's incredibly hard to do that accurately.
Yeah.
You've got to, basically the tool that he used that Ethan, or I'm sorry, Julio.
I didn't do it.
it can do about, I'd say 80%, and then you got to turn the whole thing and do it again. And then to do it consistently, you've got to do that a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need like suction cups or soft cups to hold it as you position it and you've refined that shape. It's kind of difficult to do.
Yeah, and I think on some of the posts that he did, he actually showed some cups he bought to actually hold the sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like blue, soft, whatever. Who's the other one of the other YouTube turners? Guy who's got the robust lathe. I can't think of his name. Carl.
Oh yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah,
Shop TV.
YouTube channel. Yeah.
And he's done a few spheres naturally, just handheld.
He has a podcast about turning.
Does he?
Yeah. With Braxton and And a third gentleman, I believe. It's the Woodturners Anonymous.
Oh. Well, they kind of jacked off our name, didn't they? Kind of.
I don't see
No,
how.
We're not anonymous. We're an association.
Yeah.
I just heard the A and thought.
It was really close, though.
Modern wow, Woodworkers Anonymous. Yes.
We're
yes.
anonymous, yeah.
Yes, yes. This is our weekly 12-step program.
Anyway.
That makes me guest Ethan S.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. to keep it the anonymous. But no, yeah, Julio's doing cool stuff. And go ahead and turn a sphere. Tell us how you do. Try it however you like.
Yeah. But no, I thought it was pretty cool. Pretty cool. But I want to give him a shout out since he created this whole what I call template turning on the lathe. So yeah, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Well, next up, I was kind of impressed. Woodpeckers came out with a new drill press table. Now, I do have their old table, and it's pretty nice. And but this one does look interesting. It has built-in dust collection. It kind of looks like a router table made mm-hmm. for the drill press with some of the features that it has on it. But I thought it was, you know, it's pretty unique. It's not inexpensive. But it's, you know, I would like to try it out. I want to see how well that dust collection works.
It's Damn, would cool. you agree with me? It's very expensive.
Well, let me just phrase it this way.
Yeah.
The fanciest one, the second yeah. from fanciest one is exactly twice what I paid for my drill press.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
Now, I have a Delta benchtop drill press. So it is yeah. not the most expensive drill press in the world, but it is certainly more than enough drill press for what I need as a normal woodworker. Yeah. And this table is really cool, but it's $400.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think for
and you don't I mean, get the dust I mean, this, collection, I'm not, so you I'm, get this fence, which is over $300. Yeah. You got to get into that range just to get.
Yeah,
that.
You can buy the cheapest component of it individually is $30, yeah. but by the time you put it together as a set,
yeah,
I think the base set is $369.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah. I'm with you, Kyle. I'd like to know how well that works.
Yeah.
For those that aren't looking at what we're looking at, it's basically the fence, a back fence, similar to a router table fence that has a cutout. And instead of the bit being in that cutout, the bit's mm-hmm. kind of in front of it. But that tube, the whole fence is a tube, and yeah. you can put basically dust collection at an end and suck yeah. out of it.
It's pretty slick, and I feel bad. Bad-mouthing the price because their stuff is so well made and over-the-top engineered. Yeah. It's fantastic stuff, but I have a homemade drill press table I made out of MDF, and I used to use my drill press a ton
mm-hmm.
making Pinewood Derby cars because the drill what you use the drill press for in Pinewood Derby cars is incredibly accurate, and yeah. the cars win or lose based on the accuracy of those the drilling. So
mm-hmm.
I would argue, based on our results, that my drill press table is as accurate as anything. And I remade it a couple years ago because it had come out of square and it took me about 3 hours to make out of MDF. So I don't know. Yep. Unless I was doing it production-wise, I don't know how you justify it.
Yeah. Well, you know, since I do make tools, I understand the price. It's expensive mm-hmm. to do.
But, absolutely.
But you know, one thing, this is not a one-time tool. This is something that they're going to have around, so... and I think it's kind of interesting, but like I said, before I plunk down that kind of money, I would absolutely want to see how this thing works in person. Because do you remember, what was it, a few years ago, they had tornado, but they had this attachment you could put on the drill press. It was supposed to collect all your chips, and it's like this yeah. little shroud that came over.
Mm-hmm, I have three of them.
Yeah, I bought one, and I found it very hard to use, actually, in practice. Yeah.
I literally have three of them, and I have the first generation and the second, yeah. uh-huh. And there was a huge improvement with the second one.
Okay, I think I have the first generation, I don't know if I have it or if I gave it away to somebody. I might have given it away to you.
It was not, I bought the first one. I think I got mm-hmm. the other two given to me by the tornado guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would see him at woodworking shows and he'd hand me one. Mm-hmm. we're moving on to a review of them. But what was nice is it has a mount that attaches to the headstock of
right.
the quill of
yeah.
the press. And when you remove the accordion piece, it's completely out of the way and innocuous. So
right.
it was very easy to have there, and on the drilling where it would work, you'd snap in the accordion piece and it would work great. And when it didn't work, you'd snap out the accordion piece and no harm, no foul. It was just a regular drill press then, and it wasn't in the way. So I still have it on, like, I can look over my bench right now and see my drill press, and I still have that the vacuum piece connected to the drill. And I'm sure I could find the accordion piece in the shop somewhere. But it was drilling the car, which is my big experience using the drill press on a repeated and frequent basis. I would use it like a third of the holes I would drill. But for those holes, it was perfect. So I don't slight that thing because it was cheap. It wasn't, was it $30? It wasn't particularly expensive.
No, no.
And when it didn't work, it at least wasn't in the way.
Right. Oh, I agree with that. It's just like, I don't know. It's something about, you know, actually seeing, because with that accordion piece, it's hard to see that the actual drill bit enter the wood.
And that's the difference with the second generation one, is the bottom was clear plastic on the second generation one.
Yeah. Well, enough about drills. But anyway, well, the last thing I had was Veritas came out with a new cabinet hinge template that looks like it's fully adjustable to a wide variety of hinges. And it's basically something that, you know, most people have a little shop made jig that they put together real quick if they're going to use a router to round out the place for the hinge leaves to go onto to the door or to the stile. So, but anyway, it was, I thought this was pretty unique and ingenious because it's fully adjustable and it's only $30. So if you use a router for hinges, I would pick one of these up.
Does it come assembled?
It looks like it.
Looks like it. Yeah. If not, it looks like it's just held in with a couple of, looks like, quarter inch by 20 things, but
there's just like a little black piece of like aluminum looks like that's tight on one end and adjustable on the other, and I mean it's essentially a piece of plexiglass and a couple other things. Are you saying is the like the fence board in 1/16 offset, acrylic plate register against the surface, 9 3/4 long pine fence that registers against the perpendicular. It sounds like it comes with it.
Yeah.
That's a great deal.
Absolutely.
What is it, $30? And I think this is just more of them using their CNC. I bet
this
is
coming out of the same thing as all their other.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you use a router to put your hinges, you know, to cut out for your hinges, this would be great. I know Sean and Ethan probably have no interest in this, but
no, anyway, sir.
But
I'll have to start using hinges.
But you know, I mean,
trying to figure out how you put a template on a router.
Well, the template goes on the piece, and then the router goes through it. So if you got a router plane, you could do it with a router plane. It would essentially, you could set it up to just guide the width if you had to like true up a little hinge mortise.
Yeah, but I don't think so.
That's a dismissive.
But
it seems overcomplicated for handwork.
Yes, it does.
But if you use a router for leaf hinges, you might want to look into this. I mean, at $30, it's kind of a Brusso hinges are more than $30 for a pair.
Right. Raise your hand. You've ever used a router for leaf hinge and were scared shitless to...
I've never used a leaf hinge.
Oh, really?
Really?
Okay.
I say that. Honestly, I'm like drawing a blank. What's a leaf hinge?
A simple hinge. It's
a simple hinge with the two...
Oh, I call that a butt hinge.
With the pin in the middle.
With a pin.
Yeah.
One of my first projects I made were these simple little boxes, and I had these little... I mean, they could have been 5/8 inch wide, you know, 1/4 inch in the other direction... I guess 5/8 long, 1/4 inch wide, little tiny things, two screws, nothing to them. And it was easy by hand. It was a little, you know, just kind of get it out with a chisel and a router plane to finish it off. But
Could the difference between a butt hinge and a leaf hinge be the finial on the barrel?
It very well could be.
A leaf hinge has a finial? Or
it could be Texas to the Midwest. You know, that might be the difference.
Something Texas like that, yeah.
In the Midwest?
No, well, no, is it? Texas not the Midwest.
Texas isn't in the Midwest. Texas is in Texas.
They're the South. They're their own region.
Well, that's true. I mean, well,
actually, Ohio Texas is not. Yeah. Sean, you got
yes,
that right.
Yes, we are. Texas Ohio is the Midwest. I know.
By terminology, not by location.
No, not by geography. I agree.
I'm mid north ish. East mid north in Ohio.
And what does Midwest even mean? Iowa's not even west. It's not even mid.
No,
Iowa is west.
West
New
of
Jersey
you.
Is west.
I think when they came up that with that, I think anything west of the Appalachians,
west of the Hudson.
So it was probably the Midwest.
It's an early term. The west just stretches from like Virginia to California. Yeah. We're all west.
It starts at the Palisades.
That's Eastern West.
The Eastern Western region.
All right, anyway. Ethan, we're going to have you draw a map of, you know, redefine the map.
Kyle, I thought you were going to say, Ethan, we're going to have you shut up for a little while because we're getting distracted. No.
Okay, the Midwestern, we're going to settle this right now. Midwestern United States, it's everything. Yeah, you'll love this. It's here we go. Ohio is the easternmost state of the Midwest, and it goes all the way to the North and South Dakota range.
Okay, so I'm assuming you looked it up on Google?
I did.
So that's a West Coast bias. They don't understand what the Midwest is.
No, I didn't take that back. It's not the Dakotas. It's Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. We're considered the Midwest. I don't know why. It has to be very, very old because it makes zero sense.
Why does it make zero sense? Literally everything west of New Jersey is the West, and you guys are in the middle.
Because you live
it's the Midwest.
You live in the like fourth to eastest most state in the nation.
Okay.
You know, and so your West doesn't count.
All right, okay. When the nation was founded, we were the western edge of the country.
That's true.
Everything west of us is the West.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Next up on the geography podcast. Southwest. Why do they call it Southwest?
No, the Southwest is truly Southwest, isn't it? Arizona, New Mexico. That's the truth. Southwest. I agree with that.
Texas gets lumped into the Southwest.
Basically, we can say that the central time zone is west of the Midwest, if that makes any sense.
No, because I'm in the central time zone.
The Dakotas would be on the mountain time zone.
They're in central.
Zone is the
they're
west.
Central. Okay.
They're central.
Okay.
Anyway. So what's going on in my shop, you ask?
Woodworking, yeah.
So Sean, Diami, go ahead. What's going on in your shop?
All right. A little bit. I'm building a shed. So
you're beating me to it. Go on.
In my shop right now is my big compressor and a weed whacker and framing guns, which are not often in my shop.
Roll you back. Are there purple dyed LVL?
No, there's no LV. It's all dimensional lumber. It's certainly five times the cost of a shed I could have bought. But that being said, within reason, I'm making the shed as cost effective as possible. So it is a teeny little bit of 2x6 in it, but mostly it's 2x4.
No, I guess I was saying in your shop. Is the entertainment center out of your shop?
No, of course not. I haven't touched it in months.
Okay. Just making sure.
No, the entertainment center is still serving as a desk. Mm-hmm. What I have done besides some framing, I'll mention the framing only because I'm not even going to pretend to know what I call the part in terms of a framing term, but there were pieces that I had to cut this really steep angle on, and understanding how woodworking works, I brought the saw to the tool and I knew that if I could mark a line, I could cut to the line. So I hand cut these really extreme angles that I would not have easily been able to do with a power saw.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I took out my nailing gun and put it all together. but in the shop, I have a couple things. I have spread out on the Timber Strand Entertainment Center that is serving as the workbench is another piece of laminated Timber Strand, and it's actually over in the corner of the shop. I have these bundles of Timber Strand that are from when I ripped all the pieces for the Entertainment Center. So the Entertainment Center, I bought 2x6 Timber Strand, and I ripped it into 1.5-inch by 1.5-inch squares. And rotated the mold 90 and glued it back up so it's essentially edge grain or quarter sawn. So I have these cutoffs of timber strand that are 1.5 inches wide by about 1/2 inch thick. So I glued a bunch of them together a couple weeks ago to make this slab that's, let's call it 48 inches long by 1/2 inch thick by about 5 inches wide. And it's, again, it's edge grain timber strand.
Mm-hmm.
And I dug out a piece of maple. I'm not even sure. It's a nice actual from a tree. product. And what I'm going to do there is, it was going to be Father's Day, but as we're recording this, Father's Day is some number of weeks away, two or three, or maybe only one. I don't really know, but it's coming up soon. And I say that as per someone who gets things on Father's Day, but doesn't have to give many things on Father's Day. I don't pay attention to what it is. This was going to be a Father's Day gift for my dad, but he's actually going to end up getting one of Rudy's chair carvings for Father's Day instead.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this will be for his birthday, which is at the end of the month. So there's a 2-week difference between his birthday and Father's Day. So I just have to add. Nice. So what this is going to be, long story short, is Rockler has a kit to make your own Bluetooth radio.
Mm-hmm. I think I've seen that.
It was only like $40. It wasn't particularly expensive.
Yeah.
And looking at the reviews, the sound is okay. Mm-hmm. My dad's not going to particularly care. As long as he can listen to an audiobook on it, it's going to be fine. So the sound quality doesn't need to be fantastic. And for me and for him, the most important part was that it doesn't have to be Bluetooth. It has a USB in, so you can just plug a phone into it. Or I say USB, it was actually 3.5 audio. So you can just plug a phone into it, which is how he's going to listen to it. But in any event, I'm going to make him this little radio. So I'm going to make it, there's a Rockler has a plans for it, and I'm basically using that just for dimensioning, but then, the top and bottom of it are going to be actual wood, and they're going to kind of overhang. It's going to be a very horizontal looking piece. And I think I'm going to cut a shallow curve on the front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the face and the sides and the back will be this timber strand. And I'm going to do the maple in probably just shellac, but just a clear natural finish. Maybe I'll use some rattle can varnish or lacquer, excuse me. But I'm not sure, but it'll be something clear. And then on the timber strand itself, I think I'm going to dye it red and then clear finish. That'll go with his deal.
Yeah, I'm a real convert to the rattle can lacquer. If you got something small, it's quick, easy to do.
Exactly.
But yeah. And I think it's really great that you're planning this like 3 years in advance.
Well, believe it or not, what I asked for from my family for Father's Day was the time to make this for my dad.
Leave me alone.
But believe it or not, I had one more thing in the shop, and I needed to make a marking jig for work. I'll try to sum this up quickly. We had to cut back some wooden nailers at the top of a parapet wall on the edge of a building because the carpenter installed them proud of the finished surface of the siding. So I had to make a jig.
That didn't make any sense.
Sure it does. Okay. Siding, the wooden nailers overhung the exterior face of the wall pre-siding. And
the carpenter
thought he was putting it in the right dimension. And when the siders finally put the siding up, lo and behold, the wood was sticking out too much.
Yeah,
so
mid-turned. Okay, go ahead.
And the siding is, of course, a laminated metal panel that I don't want to mess up. So I had to make a jig that could ride on the metal panels, loop around the wood, so it's kind of like a big C, and then I could write a pencil on the top of it to mark the wood flush with the panels, so that we can then go back and cut the wood flush with the panels.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a scrap of LVL that I had kicking around the shop, and I cut this thing out.
Like you do.
Yeah, like you do. I use my 16-inch bandsaw and cut some LVLs. What are you gonna do? It's basically a C, but then because I could, I grabbed my die grinder and I put a burr on the end, and I power carved a handle into it.
Well, fantastic. That's great. So that brings me to the question I had for you is, have you tried to put back together the sculpted headphone rack?
Believe it or not, I have glued one of the two antlers back on.
Okay.
When I glued it on, I did not do what you should do and kind of make up a call and practice the glue up and all that stuff. And it's these really weird angles. Mm-hmm. It's only a simple joint, but it's a tricky glue joint because you really want to call on both ends to get the glue line in force. And it's a tricky glue up. So rather than do the right thing out of frustration, because I had just recently broken it and was still angry, I put some glue in the joint and I push it together and I wrap the whole thing in blue tape. What I still have to do is kind of scrape off the little bit of glue that bled out.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to have done a much better job than I had anticipated.
There you go.
I'm cautiously optimistic that when I glue the other one together, it'll be okay. And it's not going to be perfect, but it's a battle scar, and I think ultimately it will be serviceable when it's all done.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, yeah. Good.
But now,
well, at least my square on the pool is still in play. Old.
I have a question. I have an issue with it. Maybe one of you guys can help me with this.
Yes.
The last thing I did, literally seconds before dropping it, was I waxed it. It has 11 or 12 coats of shellac on it, and I put a wax on it, and I thought I was done.
Mm-hmm.
So now, when I scrape off this little bit of glue, I'm going to end up having to refinish it, which is not a big deal, but how do I get the wax off?
Mineral spirits.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep. Yeah. I would maybe, wipe it down with mineral spirits maybe 3 times, and you'll probably get all the wax off.
Okay. I know it's not the solvent you use for shellac, but will that mess up the shellac at all?
Probably.
Which ultimately is okay, because I plan on re-shellacking it, but am I going to get,
once you wipe it down with the mineral spirits. In? Yeah, once you wipe it down with get the wax off, I would suggest, just sanding it down again with high grit, whatever you use for your last grit. And then just refinish it. There'll still probably be some finish on it. You won't have to put probably as much.
Yeah.
Would you put like 12 coats of shellac? You're probably going to have to put like.
But it's only a half pound cut of shellac. I'm putting a real thin coat on it, so it's not a particularly thick finish right now. You think if I remove the wax with the denatured alcohol,
mineral spirits.
Excuse me. Thank you. I'm thinking shellac. It's mineral spirits. I remove the wax with the mineral spirits.
Yeah.
And then the highest grit of sandpaper, I think, was 400. So if I sand it with 400, there will still be shellac on it. But I'm not going to mush the wax into the shellac and dissolve the shellac with the mineral spirits?
No,
I don't think so.
Okay.
The denatured alcohol would.
Well, yes, I realized.
Now, if you wanted to, you could remove it. You could remove the wax with the mineral spirits and then put denatured alcohol and go all the way back to raw wood. And then sand, and then refinish the whole thing. But I don't think you need to do all that. Yeah. You only need to do that if what we told you doesn't actually work.
if what you told me doesn't work, I may try to take the wax off with a grinder.
Exactly. There you go. Oh. Well, so Sean, what's in your shop?
I'll be quick and short. Nothing.
No,
the bees are doing good, and not much time for a shop. So.
Okay. No rockets, no nothing?
Hold on, Jimmy's got a question. What?
At what height do you put your bee houses?
My beehive is on 4x4s inserted into the second cinder block up, if that makes sense.
I believe he asked about bee houses, Sean.
It's a beehive. Call it a house. Whatever.
What does that make them about 3 foot high, something like that?
No, not even. No, so the cinder blocks are on their edge. So they're short. So it's just, about 18 inches. Oh, they're 8x10 or 18x10. So they're about 20 inches, but the 4x4 is inside them. So it's there. And that purely is to keep them a little bit away from bugs crawling in, but also just a little less back bending to get down.
Being the beekeeping connoisseur that I am.
Yeah, go.
The arcane one bit of knowledge I have in my head about beekeeping, which came from God knows where, is that bees survive better if the hives are higher.
I don't know that to be true, although I've seen it as example and it makes sense to me. I've not actually, from everything I've researched, I've never seen anybody have them on the ground.
It's because it's a pain in the butt when they're that high, though. I mean, well,
like
the ground is one thing, but
in the construction of the whole thing, your bottom board to your frames, to your whatever as it goes up, they enter and exit right above the bottom board. And if that's on the ground, I mean, they're like scraping grass blades.
Right. But no, I thought like 10 foot, 20 foot was better than 18 inches.
Oh, 10 foot? What the hell? Yeah. Are you climbing a ladder?
I think that's why no one does it.
Well, and it might be. But I mean, as in my experience in Midwestern Ohio.
Don't you live in Northwestern Ohio?
I do live in Northwest Ohio. But on the nice warm days that we've been having recently, they are happy to come and go out of this thing that is a near 20 inches off the ground. It's not hard to get to. And I don't know. I've never seen one super high in the air. They're usually pretty accessible to walk up to.
Did you have to, this is now we're even more woodworking than the Midwest debate, but, Do you have to buy bees and just stick them in there, or do bees come and fill it naturally?
Like we did. We did. We bought a package of bees.
Do they come frozen, or are they thriving?
No.
Freeze-dried?
They come live via the USPS.
Ah.
They were picked up. I picked them up directly from the Postal Service.
They don't deliver them?
I don't know. They could, but they're considered live. And one of the unique things about the Postal Service is that you can ship live things. You can ship chickens and stuff like over the Postal Service.
Do you think you could ship children?
If you pack them right and give them breathe holes, maybe.
I'll keep that in mind. I'm just going to tuck that away in the back.
There you go, just in case.
I do believe they had to make some laws against that because
I would ship them over state. You know, I'll keep them in New York.
No, I will say that was of starting beekeeping for the simple purpose that we're doing. We're not starting a honey company or anything. The act of picking up bees from the post office, walking in, I called them to say, okay, they're there, good, I'll be there sometime this morning. And I walk in, I said, I'm here for the bees. And the guy knew exactly what I was talking about. And he walked to the back, and another guy comes in and just hands me this thing of bees that in shipment had been broken open.
Oh, my gosh.
Hold on. Yeah, so it was a very simple box with screens on the sides, right? And that holds them. But something had punctured that side and pushed the screen inward. And so there were bees hanging out on the outside of that screen, and he just handed it to me. I went, you're kidding. He goes, they're fine, they're fine. And sure as hell, I mean, this was pounds of bees. I didn't count them. They're pounds worth. And they didn't make a sound, and they just stayed there. I carried them through the lobby of the post office. I put them in the back of my car, and I drove home, and none of them moved. They stayed right where they were, and I walked into my backyard, and I installed them into the hive, and it was the weirdest thing to have that many bees. It's a strange experience. It's just weird. I mean, my experience up until this point was bees at a carnival or at a sporting event or a concert. You know, they're hanging around the trash cans and they're annoying, and you don't want to piss them off because they're going to sting you. I've now put my hand in among thousands of bees to switch out a can of syrup that I'm feeding them, and I'm not in fear of that at all. They're just buzzing all around me, but they don't care.
Yeah, isn't the trick just as long as you don't piss them off, they really don't bother you?
It really is. Yeah. I mean, they don't want to be bothered. They know they'll die if they sting you. And they're honeybees. These aren't the other different types of
bees. Murder hornets.
Yeah, murder hornets and the like. But they really are. And actually, I read a thing that said, you know, find a mentor. And we don't have a mentor. I've got YouTube. It's just as good, right? Thank you. And but the one guy said, find a mentor that doesn't use gloves. And that sounded really weird until I kept on reading. And he said, you know, you need to pay attention and understand what you're working with. If you have that extra layer of comfort, you may get distracted more easily. It basically, if the bees aren't looking at you, literally like turning their heads to look at you, they don't care. You're fine. And so I've lifted the frames out while I'm inspecting and making sure the queen's doing good and all this other stuff in the weeks that we've had them. And so far, everything's been great. I mean, none of them have like been viciously attacking us. Now I'm covered. I've got my protection, like my hood and all that jazz.
But you're not wearing gloves?
I am still wearing gloves, but I'm really close to not. I mean, that's like there's like a growing pattern. You do these, they're like leather gloves with big ass, like up to the elbow gauntlets on them. Yeah. And then there's like, oh, use these nitrile gloves. They're just simple and you get in touch with it. And I don't know. I see guys that do it all the time. I'm not too afraid to get stung in that way because of what I'm doing. Because as I'm doing it the way I'm doing it, I'm not seeing them land on my hands naturally. Yeah. Like they're just not doing it. But it is an interesting experience for sure.
Well, yeah, sounds interesting. Y'all don't have Africanized bees up there, do you?
Well, no.
Okay.
So far, so good.
Yeah, we do down here, so yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing about buying them. Like I kind of know the source. I know a little bit of the lineage, as strange as that sounds. And so, no, these are not Africanized.
Well, apparently there's like Africanized bees will take over a existing hive or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sort of mutant thing. I don't know. Anyway, well, moving from our B podcast, let's go back to our geography podcast. So, in my hill country? Yes, in my shop. So besides working on the relief map of the United States, I finally installed a shelf in my bench after 10 years. So I built this bench, and one of the final things I wanted to do is put a lower shelf in it. And I didn't, because at the time I finished the bench, I was just like, I'm glad to be done with the bench, and I had other stuff to do, and da-da-da-da, and, you know, 10 years goes by. And so I finally looked at it and go, I'm going to put the shelf in. And so it took an exhausting about 20 minutes to actually cut it and put it in there. But after it's done, it's absolutely fantastic. I highly recommend it. So if you don't have a shelf under your bench, get on it.
All right.
And besides that, I'm just starting on a new batch of jigs to sell. So I got some working on some boring jigs this week, and I'll be making some stretcher jigs next week.
Excellent.
So that's what's going on in my shop. So, Ethan, what are you working on?
Wow. I always have a lot of things going on in my shop. Right now, I'm making a couple of journals. They're leather journals, and they have wooden splines on them.
Mm-hmm.
My son's really getting into fishing lately, and he wants to keep a journal of the fish that he catches and where they are and such. And so I said I'd make him a journal for that.
Cool. What kind of fishing are you doing? I saw that y'all were doing some, casting of the nets to catch bait fish.
Yeah, that's all him. He gets these, he's his daddy's son. He is an artist through and through, and he will sit there with his clay that you can bake in the oven, and he will make 15 or 20 different fish that are these realistic and lifelike copies of puffer fish and blowfish and rainbow trout and just whatever he's got going on in his head. He puts it out on clay, and so he'll even do like his last batch that he did a channel catfish, and then he did a skeleton of a channel catfish with the fillets cut off of it.
Wow.
So he really gets into it. I'll probably end up with some pictures of that on Instagram. I try to stick to woodworking as much as possible, but I mean, he does some amazing things, and I'm like, I gotta show that. So he taught me how to cast net. But I'm making a journal for him, and then, you know, I posted some pictures of it, and then of course I got a couple DMs from people asking if I can make one for them too. And so I kind of, with one or two of them, started doing something that I've done before with some boxes that I made. I had this guy contact me one time, and he wanted me to make a box, and he had a list of like 13 things that he wanted done, these five different kinds of wood and some cabochons on the stones. I sometimes inlay cabochon stones on the lid, some of that, and then some lining, and the, you know, but it was just, you know, he got done with the list, and I was like, wow, you want me to glue some gumdrops to that lid too, because that is what it's going to look like when we're done. I said, I'm sorry, I won't make that box. And he's like, what? And I said, yeah, I'm not going to put my name on something like that. That sounds hideous.
Yeah.
I said, but I tell you what, I said, I've had an idea kicking around in my head for a while that I really want to do. I will pull four things from your list and make sure those are incorporated in the box. It was a presentation box for Skin Do, which we can get into that later when we talk about kilts or something. But anyway, so it was a presentation box. I said, I'll incorporate, you know, four or five things that you have on your list into that box. But other than that, I'm going to follow this idea that I've wanted to do. And then I will send you the box. And if you like it, go ahead and pay me for it. And if you don't like it, ship it back. My cost. I incorporated some things, some specific things in there for the recipient of the gift, but I put them in a little removable tray so that if I needed to change anything out, I just take out the tray and I could redo the tray, but everything else is totally resellable the way it is. So he said, all right, I'll trust you. And So I went ahead and made it and shipped it off to him, and he sent me a check for $200 more than my invoice.
Oh, great.
Said it was better than anything he could have ever come up with. So I'm a big believer in letting the artist have as much leeway as possible when they're making something. And I do that when I have somebody making something for me too, you know. Give them a general idea and go for it. You know, you're the maker. Make it. Mm-hmm. So I have that. And then this other project that I have had going on since about September of last year is something I call kilted tool oilers. Tool. They're just, it's like this tiny little, so Lee Valley used to have these little boxwood containers. They were a screw off lid. It was a little round container about inch in diameter by 3 inches or so. And I bought one, and as soon as I got it, one of the first things I thought was, oh, wow, that'd be really cool if I put some wadding in there somehow, and I could soak some oil in it, some camellia oil. And then that'd be like this little oiler that I can keep in my apron pocket. And then anytime I need to oil a tool or something, you just pull it out, unscrew it, wipe it on, put it back on, and you're done. Mm-hmm. So I've had one kicking around the shop for, I don't remember when Lee Valley started selling those, but it was, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, something like that. Maybe not quite that long, 6 years ago. But I guess it was like August. I was looking at it and I thought, you know what? It wasn't too hard to make. I wonder if I could sell some of those. So I got on Lee Valley's website and I saw that they were on clearance. They were clearancing them out. And so I bought 10 of them and made some oilers and posted something up on Instagram, said, hey, is anybody interested in these? And within 15 minutes, they were all sold. I'm like, oh, maybe I got something here. So I called Lee Valley back and I ordered some more. And those sold within an hour. And I called Lee Valley back and I ordered some more. But the problem is now is that we were starting to get lower in the numbers. By the time I called the last time, I said, look, how many do you have left? And she said, well, you've purchased the last, and there are 55 left or however many it was. I'm like, all right, let's go ahead and get them all. But at that point, what they were doing is they were, contacting the Lee Valley stores, which is the only place where they were anymore, and having them pull them out of inventory and ship them back to home office. And then once they all got assembled at home office, they were shipping it to me. So I bought out the last 150 that they had. And each batch sold within an hour of me posting them. And then that's it. There are no more. So I got in touch with Lee Valley and I said, I need more. You know, I think I'm on something here. This is good. Can we get some more? And they're like, sorry, we're not ordering anymore. We discontinued that and we're not going to order them anymore. Can I get the contact information from your supplier? And they actually said, yes. They said, yeah, we're not going to carry them. So here you go. Unfortunately, it's a French company, like down in mid to southern, Midwestern France. And that was a joke, Midwest. I don't know where in France they are, but apparently they only speak French because I have emailed them and tried to contact them many times and I get nothing. I get zero from them. But I talked to somebody at Lee Valley and they said, it might just be that they don't think you're a big enough customer because they had to do an order of like 5,000 of them to get.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like, I can't buy that much, but I can buy some. I could buy a bat. You know, I'd be willing to go as high as I could. But I can't get them to, and I can't find them anywhere else, anywhere. And I consider my Google Foo to be pretty good, and I can't find them anywhere. So I am resorted to
making them.
I guess I'm making them myself, right?
So they're threaded. They're wood threaded. So
is the problem, isn't it?
So you have to chase threads then.
Or figure something out. It's what I've been trying to work on for the last couple months is trying to figure out how to handle this. If they're not threaded, they don't sell as well. I tried that too.
What if you use magnets to keep it closed?
I don't know.
It's a piston fit and a magnet and a washer, some sort of embedded metal.
That brings me to the next problem, though, because either way, I do not have room for my lathe. I have a great lathe, the 1954 Rockwell lathe in the garage, disassembled, has the original cast iron legs and full bed. It has every single accessory original to it that came with, that you could have gotten for it. It has a 12-inch rest, it has a 6-inch rest, it has a 9-inch rest, it has a 4-inch rest, it has a V-rest. It has two of the banjos. It has everything that I could want for it, except it does not come with room to set it up in my shop. I cannot set it up. Mm-hmm. So I have to try and figure out how to do this without a lathe. So that's what I've been working on. So mm-hmm. one of my ideas was to start with some dowel that is larger, so 1¼ diameter. And then mm-hmm. I'm going for a 7/8-inch diameter insert that I'm going to bore a hole out and put an insert that I've already pre-threaded 3/8 inch on it, so mm-hmm. that I'm actually adding the threaded insert to a larger dowel. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So then the problem is, what are you going to thread? What kind of material are you going to thread? I tried threading dowel. The problem is if you use a wood threading tool, they make really big threads. The opening in the middle of that gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And I really want to stick to a certain size. And so I'm like, okay, well, let me go to some machining threads. So then I had to get online and I had to buy a pipe vise and pipe thread, a tap and die. And then apparently if you're doing a tap and die with a 2-inch diameter sized, because that's how big the die is for mm-hmm. a 7/8-inch tap or for a 7/8-inch thread is large. So you have to get this big arm, this crank arm thing. So, I mean, it's like threading pipe for plumbing is what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got some copper and brass and aluminum pipe. And I was thinking, I could do some metal threading in there. It might be kind of cool. The problem, I guess one of the things that I found out is that you can tap wood pretty easily. I can tap walnut, mm-hmm. I can tap maple, right. And it really is not a big deal. The tapping works really well, but cutting the threads with a die on most wood is not easy.
Yeah.
The wood does not like to do it. So I was thinking, let's do a combination, a metal insert. So I have some brass or copper or aluminum or something else, if I can figure something else out. And then I'll actually tap the other piece of 1¼-inch dowel that I'm going to use for the lid and then just screw it on. And then getting fancy, which I've already done some prototypes with this, and I do have some posts on Instagram with some of those, using brass and copper and actually sterling silver discs, and then mm-hmm. stamping them with my stamp and then inlaying that into the top of the lid to correspond with the type of thread that I have in there. So just kind of tying it all together.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I found that I can tap really easily is this. It's fiberglass, but it's 7/8-inch diameter. It's electrical tubing.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It threads so easily. It's like butter. It's so great. And it kind of looks like wood, you're only going to see 3/8 inch of it. So I'm not totally unopposed to using that, maybe for some less expensive, because now, buying those from Lee Valley was so easy because it was this really low price and there was no time involved for me, and I'm going to have to, I got to pay myself. So
have you looked at some, the reason I say this, cause I ran down the same thing, cause I'm trying to get a reamer made, in Lee Valley. I was copying one of their reamers and I was looking all over the web, and I found that there was some Australian company that actually sold that same reamer. So I don't know if they're the ones that actually commissioned it and Lee Valley was buying it from them or not. But you might be able to find some sort of a European woodworking outfit that actually has those.
Yeah, that was that.
I don't know. Might have already been down that road.
Well, that was something I tried to do. Yeah. I did find another website, and I can't remember which one it is. I keep wanting to say McMaster Car, and it's not McMaster. It's one of those. It's more like a boutique-y kind of woodworking website, and I can't remember the name of the company. But they sell. It's a boxwood tube but it actually contains a sewing kit, like a small sewing kit. Mm-hmm. But it is, I mean, you can tell it's the same company that makes this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've tried contacting them to see if, you know, and I never got a response back from them. And unfortunately, because they have a sewing kit in there, the prices on it are too high for me to buy it, but it's basically the same thing. Yeah. You know, I'll keep on trying to go that route, but in the meantime, I'm not going to sit here and twiddle my thumbs. I'm going to see what else I can do. So that's
maybe
what I'm
make
doing.
Something steampunk out of metal.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the idea. Yeah. And then, so this is, I kind of think of things in transitions and in, you know, types, like type studies, which, you know, if you do anything with old woodworking tools, maybe that's logical. You know, I think of the boxwood ones that I have, that was my type one. Then I tried something with some friction fit lids or some friction fit tubes that I got for really inexpensive off of Etsy. From a guy who just had a big box of them. And they were a little bit smaller than the boxwood ones. And so I was a little hesitant, but I tried. And then I thought, well, you know what, let me see if I can dress them up some. So I did like leather wrap around them and hand stitched, you know, like little leather cases and lids and things like that. And it still didn't work. That was my type two. That was kind of a bust. Type three, I'm thinking, is going to be these dowels, these 1 1/4 inch dowels. Probably with the fiberglass threaded insert, because those are much less expensive than the type of piping that I have to get that will accept the threads. Mm-hmm. So that's the other problem, is that if I get copper pipe that's too thin, my thread cutter will just simply cut off a concentric circle off the pipe. So I had to go with pipe that is at least 0.065 inches thick, the wall of the pipe, which is easy with aluminum, but is not so easy with brass and copper. Anyway, so the that other stuff, that fiberglass is much less expensive. You know, I can get 3 feet of it for just a couple bucks. So for an inexpensive type three, that's what I'm thinking. And then for my next version, I was kind of going along the lines of my friend Rick up in Canada, who does things lathe free, and starting with like a chunk of walnut and then cutting it off where the division between the body and the lid, and then kind of working it from there, and then doing like maybe octagonal shapes or something where I'm not doing anything that's turned. It's all, you know. So anyway, that's like a few of the things I have on. I also have this huge box of bronze screws. I got a really great deal on eBay. It was like 2,000 bronze screws, and they were all in the original, like these thin paper boxes, you know, from like the 50s or whatever that they used to come in. And all this guy did when he shipped them to me was he just put them all into a UPS priority medium flat box. And
these are without bees.
Without bees and without bubble wrap. And so when I opened it up, I have like these remnants of 7 or 8 old boxes from the 1950s and just a mess of 2,000 bronze screws of different sizes that I need to now sort. That's also
what do you plan to do with 2,000 bronze screws?
Or resell some of them. That was the plan. I have so much stuff. I get on these kicks.
Yep.
You know, and I started going down this rabbit hole of slotted old, you know, new old stock slotted screws. And well, that gets you on a kick of buying these old union, these little storage cabinets with the divided trays so that you can put your slotted screws and by sizes. And then I found that there's this really great website. Chris Schwartz is one who I think pointed it out many years ago, but it's called blacksmithbolt.com. And that's a website where you can go and they sell like new old stock slotted screws, you know, from size 4 to size 14 or whatever. Most sizes, and you can order them in whatever quantity you need with, you know, very little minimums. But the quality of these screws is just 10 times better than anything you buy at the box store today. You know, I got so tired of camming out screws, even just with a handheld screwdriver. So I won't do them anymore. I won't use any of those cheap zinc coated screws for anything. You know, I won't use them for anything. Yeah. So now it's all old stock slotted steel screws. And then I saw that they had bronze screws, and I was using bronze screws. Oh, man, where do you guys want me to end?
You're filling in.
I was just about to say, so you know, your passion here is for the hand tool woodworking and hand tools in general, and you know, new old stock. But I think it's fascinating. I really want to get into it. But tell us a little bit about your background. So a little bit about how you came to be in the woodworking community, because
In the woodworking community,
or any you know, background,
any community,
any community.
So I grew up on a farm in a small town outside of St. Louis, Missouri, about 50 miles outside of St. Louis. So I grew up, and I have an older brother who's 3 years older than me, and then a younger brother who is 5 years younger than me. So you know, there was many years on the farm where I was either doing something with my older brother or doing something with my younger brother when he and I were doing the same things or whatever, building forts, making, you know, tree houses and fixing, but not just play, but like, you know, fixing the chicken house or the barn or one of the machine sheds. Digging through when my parents purchased the farm in 1971, it had been a farm in use for, you know, 100 years. And so the one thing I love about farms, well, our farm, is that every building has a different name. I mean, I could tell you, you know, the name of every building on the farm. There's like 15 outbuildings on the farm. They all have their own names. You know, you go in the machine shed and there's that old workbench that the old farmers used to use to work on their tractors. And it's just, you know, this wood's never going to rot. It's so coated in oil from 100 years of working on stuff. But, you know, you dig through that and you find all kinds of old screws and nails and tools. And, you know, so we would rehandle sledgehammer heads or hammers that we found. And, you know, we used hand saws. And so working with hand tools, I guess, is something I did early on. My grandfather was actually a woodworker. It's my maternal grandfather. Unfortunately, he passed away when I was 3. So I never got to, experience any of that with him. And honestly, I don't even have any of his tools. But I have stuff that he's made for us, at my parents' farm. We have a workbench that he made for me and my older brother. You know, I was 3, when he passed away. So, I wasn't that old when he was making these things for us, but it was all pallet wood back then, was maple, good quality maple, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s, which is when he started doing his woodworking. He was an architect in Alton, Illinois, and built houses there with his cousins or his uncle. And then he started a business. He built a cinder block building in like Midtown St. Louis area, and built cabinets out of there for about 10 years. And then he taught himself how to draw and paint and became a graphic design artist for like the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and things like that. So he was a very creative and artistic person. And my mom has a lot of that, and it carried down to me and also to my son. But I still have, you know, I have to post some pictures of him. He made this set of blocks that were about 6 by 6 by 6 cubes that were all miter cut on all 4 sides. And so when they're put together as a cube, you just have a cube, you know, they're all flat faces with these really thin miter joints. He did this all with pallet wood. And there's probably 25 of them, 26 of them, I think. Wow. And then on each side he has hand painted, and there's, he used different styles for, you know, he would paint letters and numbers on one face in green on this style, and then on a different side he would paint the numbers and the letters in red in this style, and he did that to all 6 sides. And so if you kind of sit there and play around with it, I can spell out my name in certain colors, and I can spell out my brother's name in certain colors. So, you know, you can see there was some logic there to what right. he was doing. Mm-hmm. I really wish I could have talked to him about it, but, you know, I've played around with it enough that I can see what he's been doing. And then he built some other toys for us that we still have kicking around at the farm. So, you know, that's something that I've always had this artistic, history in my, mm-hmm. in my family and my life that I know of. And when I got ready to go to college, my mom sat down with me and she said, you know, you're a smart kid. You can make your way in life no matter what happens to you in college. You're going to be able to figure out life. So here's how much money you earned working on the farm, because I was, you know, I wasn't just playing on the farm. I got up before school and, you know, these are stories that I can tell my grandkids whenever I have grandkids, but yeah. I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I had to go feed the steer in the barnyard with the grain and, you know, the granular molasses sometimes. And I had to go collect the eggs from the chickens, and we didn't have a garbage disposal out on the farm on a septic system. Back then they didn't have disposals that could handle that or septic systems mm-hmm. that could handle that. So we had a garbage bucket under the sink, and that's where you put all your food scraps every day, and then you take them down to the chicken house and feed the chickens. And so and I had to do that.
Everything was uphill.
No, but we have to car. There's a creek that goes through our driveway. It goes through our front field, and the driveway yeah. goes through the creek. If that creek is up, uh-huh. Then what I would have to do in the mornings is I would have to hike the southern fields, two of our fields and then two of the neighbor's fields, because the neighbor behind us to the south was the bus driver. And so I would have to get up in the morning and do all my chores and then hike, is about 2 miles or so, cross field, cross country to the bus driver's house before 7:30 so that we could get on the bus there before he got started.
Yeah.
And there were a couple times when, you know, if you didn't make that, you just had to keep on walking until you got to school, because that was in the general direction of school, which was about 7 miles or so as the crow flies. Mm-hmm. And I had to do that a handful of times. My mom was, she was pretty tough on us as far as that goes. You know, if I missed the bus, I mean, start walking.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously,
no,
that was
no other option. No, I know.
And she had a car.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
she was a stay-at-home mom.
The rule, man.
The rule is the rule.
And that made you the man you are today.
So part of it. Uh-huh. Part of it.
Well, yeah. So how did your passion for hand tool woodworking come about? Obviously coming up from this background, you know, you were well versed into, you know, the farm life and tools and, you know,
CNC's
providing for your own and
CNC. And,
yeah. Not CNCs, but anyway.
Wow. You know, in college, so my degree is in art history. Mm-hmm. And in college, I probably could have doubled as a studio art major as well, because I took just as many studio art classes, even though I didn't need to. But I loved them. So I took everything from drawing and painting to fibers and ceramics and anything in between that I could. So I love working with my hands, and I think, you know, I get a real connection to that. You really lose when you're using a tool that's spinning at 30,000 RPM.
Mm-hmm.
But my first mentor had on his left hand, his fingers were shortened by about an inch and a half or so because he lost them all to the Ooh. Second knuckle on a joiner. That was one of the first things I learned about him is, you know, he goes, look at this. I'm like, oh my God, maybe I'm getting into the wrong hobby here. but he said, no, this is just, you know, it was just a slip of attention and I got too comfortable with the tool and that's what happened. And so from the very beginning, I always had a healthy fear, you could say, mm-hmm. of the larger machines, table saw and joiner mostly. And shapers are scary.
Uh-huh. Just too exposure, too much exposed.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I did start off just like everybody else, I think, starts off in woodworking. I bought, a router. I bought a, you know, the really great Bosch, 16, 17 or whatever.
Yeah.
The
one with
the,
yeah.
yeah, one of the wooden handles on it. I still use it sometimes, yeah. Like, you know, once every 2 or 3 years, I have a need for mm-hmm. it. So yeah. I use it.
Yep, and I got the same one, and I'm probably about this. Yeah, probably about every 2 years, I'm thinking.
Yeah, and it's great when I need it.
Yeah,
I guess, you know, if I do. And then I bought a rigid contractor style table saw, mm-hmm. and assembled that myself and got it put together, and that was a feat. And it was dead square too, out of the box. You know, I love that. That was a great saw. But you know, there were a couple times that I used it that I, as I was using it, I was thinking to myself, this isn't the way you should be using this. And finally, I kind of started getting into some hand tools. And I thought, you know, what can I do to not use that table saw as much? Because there were things that I wanted to do that I didn't know how to do with the tools that I had. You know, so I had to start trying to figure out what do I need to do here? And the end result being, I needed to buy more tools or different tools. So I ended up setting the table saw aside. I did buy a bandsaw. In fact, mm-hmm. I bought the bandsaw from my first mentor's estate. He passed away a couple of years after he and I stopped working together. And so I bought his bandsaw. It's a 1978 Rockwell bandsaw. Mm-hmm. I picked up a Rockwell 12-inch drill press that I bought from the original owner, who bought it in 1951. And I bought that in 2004, 2005 or so, mm-hmm. Just in absolutely perfect condition. The way, you know, he maintained that thing for 50 years.
Yeah,
you know?
That's fantastic.
And it's a machine. It just doesn't budge on anything. So it's, I use that. So I have in my shop now, those are my two power tools. I have a Rockwell Delta bandsaw and lathe. I'm sorry, a bandsaw and drill press. And I have a lathe, but I don't have the room for it. So that's up in the garage. That's the extent of my power tools in the shop right now.
Wow. So not even a planer then?
Nope. So my brother and I.
There are a lot of hand tool people. At least. Okay. I'm going to get a planer.
I do have a planer. Okay. But it's not here in the shop. My brother and I are setting up a shop. He has a farm as well. My parents actually have mm-hmm. two farms. And so he lives on the second farm with some acreage they gave him. And we mill lumber down on that farm. Well, we cut down the trees and then his neighbor mills it. And then we store it in the 100-year-old barn there. And so I have a planer down there. And when I need more walnut, I go down to my stack in the barn and I will plane it to what I need and then bring it back up here.
Oh, okay.
Well, so I do have a planer. Do you remember Steel City?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Steel City. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the guy who was the designer for the Steel City tools, when Steel City shut down, he started his own. He got permission from the original owners of Steel City to make his own planer, and mm-hmm. I guess he makes a lot of the Steel City tools. Mm. So it's the exact same thing, basically. It's just under a different name, and I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. But
is it right after Steel City was doing the granite tops?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, my drill press is a Steel City drill press. It was based off the Delta one. Everyone seemed to rave at it at the time, and yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it's a 6.5-inch quill drive. Most drill presses don't have that. Yeah.
No. And the nice thing about this one is it came with the carbide blades. It's not a spiral carbide, but it is a carbide cutter head on it.
Yeah.
So cool. I mean, it's a machine too. I can bog it down, but that's because I'm not using it the right way. I'm not as comfortable with those, you know, a planer's pretty safe though, but I'm not quite as familiar with that. It takes me a little bit of messing around with to dial in. It's a lot easier to pick up my number 7 and join an edge. Yeah.
But with your hand tool woodworking, so you've kind of delved deep into, you know, some of the hand tools. I know you have affinity for spokeshaves like I do. And
actually, no, it's not spokeshaves. It's not spokeshaves. Nope. I do not. I have a couple.
Well, no, you have the affinity for the beading
That is correct. I do. I collect beating tools. I have possibly the most extensive collection of beating tools that is in existence.
Well, the reason I said spokeshaves is because I do have one of those cigar spokeshaves, so I did closely follow your video on how to sharpen those. So.
Oh, man, I love that. That is my favorite spokeshave. Yeah, Miller's Falls number one.
Yeah.
That's my favorite spokeshave.
Right. I have one of those, and then I have a Stanley. Golly, I forgot what you call that, but it's practically round, but it's got two handles, and you can unscrew the handles and make it kind of like a T-handle.
I believe that's the 51, but I'm not as familiar with spokeshaves, but I can.
But anyway, that's one spokeshaves crept in my mind. But yeah, you do have quite a few videos on beating.
Yeah, I like beating tools. So the first one I found was it was from Patrick Leach, who is my my pimp, and he's got my number, and he calls it all the time. Yeah. So there was many years ago I was on his list, and I found this tool that I thought was just the coolest looking little thing. It was only about 2 inches tall and about 4 inches wide, and it was an old Preston beating tool, and it kind of looks like the hip bones because it's got these holes in it. Mm-hmm. It's a really weird design, but it's the Preston 1393S beating tool, and I bought it and used it and loved it. And I was using it one day and I thought, wow, this feels familiar. This feels like I should know something more about this plane. Like I've seen it before or something. I couldn't. Right. And so I started thinking about it. I'm like, you know what? I remember what it is. And I started digging through a file cabinet that I had and one of the folders was like things that I want to get or eventually. And I found it. What it was is, in 2004 and 2005, Woodcraft had done a bronze copy of this old beating tool. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it was a bronze copy of the old Preston 1393S. And I had seen it at the time and thought, that is a great looking tool. I might have to get that. And then totally forgot about it. So we're talking 6 years later, and I got on Woodcraft's website, and there was nothing about it at all. But you know, I didn't give up, and I started searching and did some more searching, and I kind of used some keywords that I found, and I found at the time, I guess Woodcraft was fairly new, and maybe their website wasn't so great. They had a bunch of dead links, a bunch of dead pages that, so when they discontinued something, they didn't delete the page. They just deleted the links to the page. So I found the page that mm-hmm. had the tool. They had the ID number that's in the Woodcraft inventory system and, you know, everything else. And so I called Woodcraft and I said, hey, I know this is a long shot because you guys quit selling it like 3 or 4 years ago, but can you check the inventory of all the Woodcraft stores and see if maybe one of them has this in stock still or something, you know? And the guy's like, yeah, sure, hold on. So he checked and he goes, yep, there is one in Oregon. And there was one in, I think it was Minneapolis. And so I called those stores, and they both still had them. They were able to put their hands on them, and so I bought both of them.
As you do. You know,
as you do.
Box they were the last tubes. You know,
they were the
planes,
last
just,
two. Yeah. They were the last two.
Yeah.
And the last probably two. Collecting dust on some shelf that was long forgotten.
When I spoke to one of the people in the store, she goes, I just moved that thing yesterday to dust the shelf in the storage room. And I was thinking to myself, how are we going to sell this tool when it's not in the system anymore? We don't have it out on the shelf for anybody to buy it. It's just sitting here in our storage room. And she goes, and then you call today about it?
They were sitting there waiting for you.
Serendipity. It was waiting for you.
I had called and left a message at the first place and said I was interested in it. And before they could call me back, I had called the second place and she had it. And so I bought it. And then the first place called me back. And I'm like, all right, I'll buy it too. So I bought that. And then I ended up selling. I did sell one of them to a friend of mine here in the St. Louis area for the price that I paid for it. I did not do any kind of a markup on it or anything. I don't try to make money with things like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, I got it in the hands of somebody who I knew was going to use it. But anyway, so that kind of those two tools were the onus for my collection. Yeah. And then it just kind of went downhill from there. There's a couple other Preston tools. There's some nice British tools out there that are beading tools. You know, one of the problems with Preston was that they did some stuff that they never marked. And so, you know, I have a beading tool that is older than all of the other Preston beading tools that I have. And I'm pretty positive that it was made by them as well, but there's no marks on it that I can use to verify that. I get really into, and so once you get that copy of Quirkus magazine, you'll see that I really start digging into history and when I can, and, you know, I will email companies and try to, I emailed a company in Germany a couple months ago about some Preston stuff. And they emailed me back and she said, you know, we went and looked back into our history of some of the catalogs and she got the answer for me that I needed. And it was, she's like, you know, back then the company was owned by these two brothers and they were mostly distributors of tools. And so they probably distributed these tools that you're asking about. They didn't make them in any way, but they were, they were resellers in Germany of these British tools. And that's what I was looking into.
Well, that's cool. Cool. So tell us about Quirkus magazine. I mean, it's a new magazine on the scene.
It is a new magazine on the scene, but Nick Gibbs is the publisher and editor, and he's not at all new on the scene. Nick has been publishing and editing woodworking magazines for 25 years. I don't remember all the names of them, but Good Woodworking, British Woodworking, those two. And then there was one before Good Woodworking, the first woodworking one they did. I don't remember the name of that one, or the one he did before British Woodworking. Good Woodworking was the last one he did. And that was the one that had John Brown as the, as a contributing writer, a regular in every issue.
Is he in the foreword of the, Chris Williams book?
He is. Yes.
He's the one that wrote the foreword.
So, Nick contacted me out of the blue last November and said, hey, somebody directed me to you and your website and your Instagram. And I started reading through some of your stuff and read through your couple of years worth of blogs, and which is not as my blog is not as active as I would like it to be. I found Kyle, you'll appreciate this. I found Instagram a couple of years ago and my blog just fell by the wayside. Instagram is so much easier.
It is.
It's a curse. I enjoy writing. I love writing. And unfortunately, Instagram is terrible for writing. You know?
Yeah,
You can barely put a return in, much less, you know, a space between paragraphs. Anyway, he said, you know, I found that and I started reading your stuff. And he said, I think I need somebody like you in my magazine. And he said, I think you would do a great job. And would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, who is this? What kind of joke is this? Somebody from a woodworking magazine contacted me to ask if I wanted to be a regular contributor. That doesn't happen. so I started looking into it. It did. I started looking into it and I'm like, wow, he's legit. He's a real person. And wow, he really has done a lot of woodworking magazines. And then he said, what he said he wanted is he wanted to inject something new into a magazine. And so he thought, you know, on a British magazine, let's inject some Americanism. And he said, but the thing is he goes, you write enough and the way you word things, he goes, is kind of the way we write things in England. You know, he said your sentence structure and formation. Right. I think people would really enjoy your writing style. And so we talked about it and agreed on it, and that's where we ended up. I don't know how much he talks about it or not, but in the reason Good Woodworking magazine quit production was because Nick was in an accident. He was bicycling on a road and he got hit by a motor vehicle and he ended up with some head injury. Yeah. So he had to stop doing publishing for a while. So this is him getting back into publishing after some recovery. That's what he's doing.
That's good to hear, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I looked at the, like I said, I'm waiting on the issue.
Me too.
The, all of his stuff in here is just fantastic. I mean, Rudy has an article in here, and I mean, there are so many luminaries in here, including yourself. And I mean, you got Drew Lancaster. I don't know the last time he had an article. I mean, it's just fantastic. Some of the folks that you have in this magazine, so I'm really excited about it. I think Drew's done some stuff recently, but I mean, it's just not, somebody that you see every day. He's not publishing in your, you know, your typical magazines like your,
Final. Well, you know, this isn't my first, rodeo either.
Yeah. But, well, I was about to say, so who else have you contributed to the past?
And you know, they're not huge articles. They're just, two in-grain articles, but I do have, two in-grain articles, that are in Popwood.
Mm-hmm.
I just happen to know the off the top of my head. It's issue 180, December 2009, was my first article. It's called "But Aren't You a Woodworker?" And then issue 212, August 2014, was something called "Take Your Home to Work." So when I'm writing, something that's kind of difficult for me is coming up with, like, what do you want to write about? I could sit down for 5 hours with a blank piece of paper in front of me. And if I don't have something in mind already, I can't just start writing. But when I get an idea about something that I need to write, that's when, and you know, it just all comes out, and I can, you know, I have my own writing methods of whatever. I don't need to go into that, but, it's very easy for me to write down what I need to write and say, and then edit it down to what it needs to be. That's something that Megan really enjoyed about actually both my articles. She said she didn't have to, she didn't have to change one thing in either of them, except I guess one of them had, just for layout reasons, one of them had a hanging paragraph or something. So she asked me to write an additional sentence just to fill it out a little more. So I did. The first one was about, you know, when I'm doing
Wait. You just passed over something. That's incredible. So Megan did not have any changes, or the only changes she asked you is to add an additional sentence?
My degree is in art history, so I wrote probably 5 to 8 papers a semester in college. And then I was a technical writer for I've been a tech writer for 15 years.
You passed the judgment of a Shakespearean lit major. I mean, that's pretty darn good.
But you know, in my mind, and it's probably not, is it? But I assuming writing for Megan is like going through the gauntlet. And it's probably not. She's probably very nice. Yeah. Well, she is very nice.
Well, no, she's nice. She's nice. But
She's a very nice person. But I imagine she is rather demanding. So,
But I mean, I read through, you know, I read through everything that I write 12, 15 times before I, you know, and I make edits all the time. And I write everything out. I will, when I'm writing about something, and that's how I did it for the article for Quercus too, I get some notepaper and I sit down and I start writing out the important things that I want to cover. I just kind of batch them out, you know, on different pieces of paper. And then I'll sit there and I'll try to figure out the order in which it needs to be. And then the paragraphs that tie everything together. It's kind of, that's kind of a really basic look into how I write. It seems to work. That's how I did it in college. I mean, that's how I did it for every single art history paper that I ever wrote. And that seemed to work well back then.
Well, I just didn't want to pass that by that you got through.
No, well, thank Megan you. I was really
as
proud.
I imagine.
Yeah. I was really proud when she contacted me back and she goes, "Looks good." I'm like, "Do you want to want me to review the edited copy or something?" She goes, "No changes. Looks good." I'm like, "Dang. Oh, good." So the first article was, you know, when people know you're a woodworker, they expect you to do everything. And I was at one point, when I was married, and we had a house and we were thinking about redoing the kitchen cabinets. And so I was, you know, told people I was looking for cabinets, and they're like, "Why don't you make cabinets?" I'm like, because that sounds horrible.
Yeah, it does.
Sounds especially awful. As a hand builder. Plywood and just squares and face frames. So, but then, you know, I'm like, "Nah, I don't make cabinets." "Well, but I thought you were a woodworker." I'm like, "Well, I am a woodworker, but that doesn't mean I do everything, you know." Doctors don't do everything. Brain surgeons don't, you know, they focus on something. So that's something that I kind of picked up from a class that I took many years ago, with Frank Klaus. I don't know if you guys know who Frank Klaus is.
Oh, yes.
Hungarian, who
just a little bit,
he lived behind the Iron Curtain and was able to escape and move to America with his wife.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate enough to take a class with him, actually two classes with him, 2009 again, I guess, mm-hmm. because that was when I got that idea for Aren't You a Woodworker? And that was just a lecture class with him. But it was, you know, 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, and sitting in chairs, listening to him talk and him showing us how to do things. And one thing that he said was he went on about, you know, you Americans, he goes, when I'm working on something and I build this, but if I need carving done, I have somebody else do the carving for me. If I need some turning done, I have somebody else do the turning for me. But he goes, you Americans, you're always trying to do everything. You try to, you know, you want to. I don't have the quote memorized right now, but, you know, you want to carve and you want to make cabinets and you want to turn on the lathe. And he goes, and by not focusing on one thing or even just a couple things, you don't ever become really good at anything. Mm-hmm. So I kind of took that to heart, you know, and decided that right. I'm going to try to limit what I do. I don't know how well that worked.
Eventually, yeah, the old saying, yeah, jack of all trades, master of none.
I sure try to keep that in mind as I'm working on things, you know. If I need a bowl, I'd rather buy it from a wood turner than try to make it myself right now. You know, I've got too many other things I need to work on. I've got too many other things I want to do.
Exactly.
Well, but what was the question?
I think you answered it. I think
so. The second article was. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Second. I was going to say the second article was called "Take Your Home to Work," and what that was based off of a class that I took. Another class that I took with Matt Cianci, who is the Sawright. TheSawright.com, Matt Cianci, a really great guy. And in fact, we brought him again, it was the St. Louis Woodworkers Guild. We brought him in to teach us a class. But this was a hands-on class, making your own back saw, making a sash saw. Yeah. And so we had like 14 people signed up for it. And in order to save money, quote unquote, for the guild, I offered to put Matt up in our guest room while he was down here. Also, I had Matt Cianci staying in my guest room for three nights or whatever. So, that was my real motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
But so Matt and I got to talk about a lot of stuff, and I got to show him the shop, and he showed me a bunch of things, and we talked tools. But then in this class, though, too, we had to make a handsaw. One of the things that we couldn't complete it all in one weekend, it was just there wasn't enough time to teach a class with 14 people in a shop that wasn't quite set up with like sharp blades on the bandsaw or you know, good sandpaper on the belt sander. So it went slower than it was supposed to. So one of the things that I ended up having to do later was shape my handle. We had it cut and fitted and everything, and the bolts were cut, the connecting threaded nuts were fixed, and we could assemble it, but the handle was still a chunk. And so I needed to finish it by a certain time, and I forget exactly why, but I didn't have enough time at home in the evenings to do it. And so I was trying to figure out how I could get this thing done. And then I realized I was just using rasps and sandpaper. Why don't I do it on my lunch break at work? We had this pavilion out behind our building. Our work purchased back in the early 2000s, we purchased 32 acres of land about 25 miles outside of St. Louis County area. And that's where we ended up building our new facility. And so we've sold some of it, but we still have 23 acres of land out there. So we have walking trails and woods and fields and a big pavilion that has trees all around it. And so I thought, why can't I just go out there on my lunch break and just bring like one of those old hand, those wooden hand clamps and clamp that to the picnic table out there and just work on my, you know, I'm not taking my work home. I'm taking my home to work.
Right.
Right. And so that's take your home to work. That's where that came from. And so then I wrote an article.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So those just were enough to give me a taste of, I want to do more writing about woodworking, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But man, the hard part is trying to come up with something that a magazine is willing to publish, right. you know, especially since, you know, they mostly, you know, they regurgitate a lot of what they've published before. Mm-hmm. It's hard mm-hmm. to find new stuff.
It is.
Well, hopefully with this one, because I was impressed with the table of contents, you know, it looks like there is some, you know, and maybe it's because it's a magazine based in England, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, maybe I haven't been exposed to, but if I've right. been reading other English woodworking magazines, I might have been, yeah.
Yeah. The focus of Quirkus magazine is definitely yeah. hand tools. It's a hand, yeah. it says it on the cover. This is a hand right. tool focused magazine. And, you know, it's funny when Nick and I sat down and first started talking about what I was going to write, mm-hmm. it was 500 to 800 words. And then as I started writing, I was like, hey, do you mind if push it to 1,000? And he's like, well, send me what you have and I'll see. And I sent it to him and he goes, keep writing.
Oh, keep writing. Let's go for 2. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I ended up at 1,100 or something, okay. you know, and I edited it down. I actually had yeah. 1,500 or more, but I cut it down to, you know, I'm actually pretty good at editing my own writing. I've been doing it for a long time, but, you know, my goal is to, I'm not going to tackle anything that I've ever read in any woodworking magazine. I'm doing my own stuff. You know, mm-hmm. I'm looking at this, and that's how I end up with these tools that I don't collect anything but beating tools. I have 15 beating tools because that's all that's ever been made. Right. There aren't any more.
That's all of them. Every one yeah. of them.
Including,
I got all the old ones. I got all the new ones. I got.
Yeah. You yeah. know, I have, there's three types from Windsor tools, which is actually not the name of a company. It's more like a location. They all came out of Windsor, Connecticut. But there actually was not a company called Windsor Tool Company. But I have there were three distinct types of tools that came out from I believe two different manufacturers in Windsor, Connecticut. And I have all three of those. In fact, that is we will go into that later, won't we? That's actually not my favorite tool, so I'll go into it right now. One of my favorite beating tools that I have is a Type 1 of the Windsor beating tool that is it is in almost pristine, unused condition, and it was built in 1880 or 1870 was when it was manufactured, and it has almost zero wear to it. It is unused. That was another Patrick Leach tool. But, you know, I have those. There's a company in Kansas City called the Kansas City Windsor Tool Works. And there was a guy there, I don't remember his name right now, but he made versions of the Type 2 and the Type 3 Windsor beating tools. And I was able to track down some of those. Lee Valley has 1, 2, 3 different beating tools out. They have a wooden one. They have one that I wouldn't recommend at all, is the worst beating tool that I own. It has this really long, awkward handle. And then they made a copy. It's not cast steel. It's not stainless steel. What is it? It's some type of it's a steel version of the, it's a cast metal. Anyway, it's a version of the Preston 1393S. So I have the original, I have the Woodcraft bronze version from 2004, and then Lee Valley has this version out as well. So I have all three of those. But again, I have like 15 or 16 manufactured. I have some others that are obviously user-made, but, you know, it's a small collection. But I still have a ton of tools around here because I will see something that just, it intrigues me and it draws me in. And I'm like, whoa, what is that? You know, the article that I wrote in the first issue of Quirkus is about a depth stop that fits on the old Stanley number 18 and number 22 countersinks. And if you look through old Stanley catalogs, there's not even a number for this depth stop.
Yeah.
It's just, you can buy the old the number 18 countersink.
Yeah.
Or you can buy the number 21 countersink, which is the 18 with a depth stop on it that is adjustable. And
it works on the other one. Yeah.
And it works. And it doesn't work on, and the other version of the 22 that they have is a, It's a blued steel. It's not. So the 18 is nickel plated, and then they did a blued steel version. But so that's what I did that article on, you know, 1200 words on this tiny little depth stop that doesn't even have a number in Stanley catalogs. That's what I want to write about. That's what I want to find out, you know, about things like that.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Well, great. Well, let's, before we move on to our fortnightly beer choices, I got one question for you is, tell us about your passion for kilts. Why are you the kilted woodworker?
Well, you know, I don't always wear a kilt when I'm in the workshop. That would be a gimmick.
You just destroyed my whole.
I'm sorry.
Oh no.
Yeah.
But I wear it when I'm doing other things too. I wear it when I'm hiking or I got married in a kilt in 2007.
I assume Scottish.
There was something.
Scottish.
You know, my history is actually more Irish and English. Okay. And Scottish, but definitely from the United Kingdom is a big percentage of it. Yeah. So it's hard. Once you get to the United Kingdom, it's hard to focus. You have to start going by name. Yeah. And the last name Simcox is associated with down in Cornwall, which is southern England. But there was also some Irish on my mom's side of the family. And anyway, so when my best friend, who's been my best friend since peewee soccer, so sixth grade, seventh grade, around there. He and I played soccer together and we went to high school together. We're a year apart, but we most of high school together. And then when we went away to school, I went to Northeast Missouri State University, which is now called Truman State up in Kirksville, Missouri. And I went to school there. And he followed me a year later, and we were roommates for a couple of years. And when he got married, I was the best man in his wedding. And too late into the planning process, we thought about wearing kilts because he is Scottish. He has some Scottish heritage. Anglin is his last name, and but it's on his his grandma on his dad's side, I think. Anyway, we couldn't pull it off in time, and so. Several years later, when I was going to get married, the first thing I did was call him up and ask him if he was going to be my best man. And he said, yeah. And I said, do you want to wear a kilt? And he said, yeah. And I said, all right, that's what we're doing. So that's what we planned from the very beginning of doing that. And that was a lot of fun. I absolutely spent more on my wedding outfit than my at the time my fiance spent on her bridal.
Yeah.
I will admit that. As you do. Well, because there's a lot of accessories that go with a kilt. It's not just the kilt.
No, there is. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And I go ahead.
Yeah, in this area of the country, I mean, we have a lot of Scottish and Irish and a lot of Scots. And we have this one event every year that, I mean, you name it, every Catholic school comes out with their bagpipe brigades and all
their
this kind of
drum
stuff.
Bands. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all in kilts. And yeah, you start looking at them and going, wow, there's a lot of stuff that goes on to wear the whole thing. Yeah.
Sean probably has a lot of that up too in Northeastern Ohio. There's a lot of Scottish games that go on up there.
Yeah.
Not a ton.
Not a ton. If you have a couple of years, a lot to me.
Yeah, that's true. They're around. We have a large Polish and German in this area, specifically in my area.
Yeah,
not a ton of Irish and the like.
And Scottish, sure. So that kind of kicked off one of the woodworking things that I did for a long time and still do, honestly. So one of the things that you wear with your kilt is a little knife that you keep in your right stocking. It's called a skindoo.
Yeah.
And so, I don't do things small. So I found a guy in Scotland who lives in an old converted flour mill that he and his wife live on that is just off of the shore of Loch Ness. And he sends me pictures every now and then. I'm like, you bastard. You know, because he's got these huge sweeping oak trees, these big bur oak trees, and sheep running through the fields. And there's Loch Ness in the background. And he's got this old stone. You know, jerk. Anyway, he actually does CNC for a living. He builds CNC machines.
Yeah, like you do.
But his side job is that he makes skindu. He uses his CNC machines to do the intricate carving in the handles. But he uses bog oak. That was one of my first experiences with bog oak. That's where I found, what is bog oak? Oh my God, bog oak. So, So I had him make us a pair of skindu, and I gave one to my best man as his best man present. Mm-hmm. And along with it, I made a presentation box for it. And I used bog oak and I used white oak from 150-year-old white oak that is reclaimed from a building on our second family farm. I dismantled a house on the farm and saved as much of the wood as I could. So I made that for my best man, and I took some pictures of it, and I sent them to Rab up in Scotland. And I didn't know this, but he put those pictures on his website. And the next thing I knew, I started getting an email every now and then from somebody that would say, hey, can you make me a presentation box for my skindu?
Oh.
Yes, I will. Yes. So I made, over the years, I've made, you know, more than two handfuls, less than two dozen. But at least half of them went over to England and Ireland. Boxes, which the shipping is a bit pricey on that, especially when you double box them like I do. I bubble wrap in a box to ship to the UK. I'm not going to take any chances after I've spent so much time and effort on something to,
They're not.
And
don't get me started on international ships.
Yeah, no. That was how I made the one box that, the guy wanted the 13 things. And that was actually for one of his best friends had just made the New York City pipe and drum band. And he wanted to give him a present to commemorate the achievement. And so he bought him a pair of skindu and asked me to make a box for that. So that's what I was making. He wanted, that was one of the other things he wanted. He's like, can you some carving in the lid, maybe like a commemoration of what it is. I'm like, man, I don't do all that stuff. I can't, you want me to carve? What? So, I don't work harder. I think smarter. I contacted the NYPD pipe and drum band and I said, hey, do you guys have any like pins or, like, medallions or things, something that I could buy from you guys that I can inlay into this box, because he wants something that is related back to the NYPD pipe and drum band for this presentation box that I'm making for so-and-so. And he's like, oh yeah, you just made it in the band. I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm making this box for him. So anyway, do you guys have anything like that? And he said, what's your address? And then he sent me two CDs and some stickers and a bunch of lapel pins and, all these different things. And I just kind of picked what I wanted, and I was able to cut the pin part off of the badge and just inlay that into the box. That was much easier than trying to figure out how to carve, some shield and symbol or whatever into a box.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense.
So I don't do that nearly as often, but I still get an email every now and then from, but nowadays Rab and I will, Rab is the guy in Scotland. He and I will even collaborate on something. So we will purchase cabochon stones from a guy who's out on the Isle of Skye, I think is where he lives. It's another Scottish guy named Matt. And so Matt he'll make a cabochon stone for me to inlay in the lid. He'll make a cabochon stone for Rab to put into the pommel of the knife. And then we'll tie them together like that. And so then I'll make a presentation box that ties into the knife that Rab is making.
Wow. That is cool.
It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. I love that kind of stuff. And I always try to challenge myself with that too. The last one that Rab gave me was a real challenge. He called me up and he's like, hey, I got this guy. He doesn't necessarily want a box. He wants something that he can keep on his desk at work that will remind him of his cool skindu that he has at home.
Hmm.
I'm like, wow, that's, so I called the guy I didn't call him, but we emailed back and forth. I'm like, so, what kind of parameters do we have here? And he was so vague and I couldn't figure out what to do. And so I said, how much are you willing to, what's your price range here? And he gave me the price range. And I said, for that price range, you want a box that's made out of all bog oak with like dovetailed box? And he goes, yeah, let's do that. I'm like, all right, we'll do that. So, I hadn't cut dovetails by hand in years. and not in wood that costs $27 or more.
I was about to say.
And so it was, I was a little nervous. I was a little nerve-wracking. Yeah. And you know what? I'm so used to, I've been working with air-dried walnut from our farm for years now, for a couple of years now. And it's so easy to work. Air-dried walnut is just a dream. I love it. And to switch to 5,000-year-old kiln-dried bog oak, which is white oak, was different. That was a little bit of a shock to me. I mean, it wasn't a huge shock, but it certainly was. I was like, this is not as easy as my walnut. The heck's going on here? but you know, there was not nearly as much give. It was not as forgiving. It was not forgiving at all. So I had to be dead on with those dovetails. And let me tell you, I was happy when I got that assembled. And
that was so cool.
It looked really good. I was happy with that. So anyway, I sent that to him, and man, he loved it and paid full price for it.
That's the important part right there.
That is the important part.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get into a whole thing about pricing your work, but you know, before I even start off with how much time I'm going to spend on a box or something, if you want hinges, I use Brusso hinges. I'm not going to use anything. I don't use cheap pressed hinges from the box store. So if you want hinges, that's $35 right there plus installation. So, you know, that, do you want a lock? That's going to be another, you know, $100 because the locks that I buy come from England. I don't buy crappy locks. It's too hard to install them.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
They're too irregular. And you end up with, I won't go into it, but, I won't buy them. I'm not going to buy cheap stuff. And so, you know, when you start off with a box that I'm going to make for you, the minimum price before I even start working in my time could be $175 just with materials and installing those materials, you know, much less making the box. I got to pay myself, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I completely understand.
Yeah.
Well, that is fantastic. So, why don't we move on to our fortnightly beer choices? So, Sean, what are you drinking?
Earlier, I finished it since, but I was happy to find, actually, a buddy of mine pointed me into the fact that a four-pack of six packs of Dogfish Head summer brews.
It's called a case.
And no, but it's six. It's four different beers. It's a case. But... included in this summer pack of Dogfish Head is Festina Pesh 60 Minute IPA, the Slightly Mighty IPA, which is their low calorie, whatever, and Sequench, which I absolutely love. But
Festina was a really good
one. Festina Pesh, I don't know if it's peach, pesh, whatever, peach. It's a peach Berliner Weiss, right?
And it's actually very good, not terrible like.
I know, it's very good. It's refreshing on a hot day. It's just and it's super smooth. Festina, get it. It should be available everywhere. If they're selling it at Costco, my God, it should be everywhere.
At least everywhere Dogfish Head is available.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think they're branching out. They're more.
They are. They
They're more of a national brand.
Still holding true to their roots, I think, as far, you know, so far at least.
Yeah.
Better than InBev. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. So,
I live in the St. Louis area, and I can't say anything good about InBev or most AB products.
Yes. Well, I am drinking a Spindle Tap Brewery, which is a local Houston area brewer, and it's called the Houston Haze IPA, which is absolutely fantastic. Spindle Tap, I've recommended another one of their brews before, and they're quickly becoming my favorite local brewery. So if you're anywhere near the Houston area, check them out.
Certainly will.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and the Houston Haze IPA, it's a cloudy IPA, a lot of citrus. It's fantastic.
Okay, is a Houston Haze IPA, I know what an East Coast IPA tastes like. I know what a Vermont IPA tastes like. I know what a West Coast IPA tastes like. What is a Texas IPA? Tastes like
this one is flavored off of a New England.
So it's a proper IPA.
Exactly. Okay. So we could do East Coast here. You know, there's just a hint of barbecue flavor in it.
That sounds so gross.
It does. It sounds like a smoke beer or a sour. Ugh.
I just had to add that in there.
Right?
That,
I don't mind
there there's smoke, no right? hint of barbecue whatsoever in this. But,
no,
you know,
it's a just got to poke Diami and oil. That's what's in it. Diami, what do you got?
In honor of one of our original co-hosts and perhaps a founding member of the community, I am drinking a High Life, which is an East Coast IPA made by Cigar City Brewing in downtown Tampa.
Wow. Is that native to your area?
It is native to the East Coast.
Wow.
Tampa is on the west coast of Florida, which is still east of the Midwest.
Yeah. I thought you said High Life. And I was
not Miller High Life.
Yeah, that's what that was my first thing too.
No, there's no champagne here.
I was going. So the only
I remember that was the first beer I ever had a sip of. That's what my grandma used to drink. She'd open up a 16-ounce bottle of Miller High Life and nurse it over 2 days.
Well, at that time, it was only brewery, brave enough to put their beer in a clear bottle. So
yeah,
brave's probably not the right word.
Well, anyway, so Ethan, what are you drinking or recommending tonight?
I mean, I have Guinness.
Guinness is great. Yeah,
I love Guinness.
Murphy Stout though over Guinness Stout. That's
Can I call it a local brewery? Because I've been if you've been to the Gravity Bar in Dublin, that's in the Guinness Brewery. There's a bar that is located about 3 or 4 stories up above the rest of the factory that has a 360-degree view of Dublin and the surrounding countryside.
Oh, cool.
That's the best Guinness I've ever had. Right there. You know, I try other beers every now and then, but I'm not one for venturing out too far,
No, Guinness is a great beer. It's fantastic.
I love it. You can drink it warm. You can drink it cold. Yeah. I prefer it warm.
I've never had it warm. I know you can.
Have you tried the Murphy Stout?
Yeah. Yeah. I've tried a bunch of stouts. You know, I was my best friend and I would go do these stout tasting things at a local Whole Foods, I think, was the one that did it. They would do different tastings with alcohol, and one of them was a stout thing, and they got all into all these expensive imperial stouts, and I couldn't stand any of the expensive ones. And I was like, give me that Guinness spec over there. That's good. I'll take the Guinness.
Exactly.
I like, going to IPAs every now and then. Those are really good in the summertime. I'm sitting out on the deck and grilling or something. I like a nice citrus beer.
Well, fantastic. Well, with that, so Ethan, where can folks find you on the interweb?
My website is thekiltedwoodworker.com. That's technically it's my blog, but WordPress is such a really good website base for, I have other pages on there where I have, links, references for places where I look for tools or find tools or buy, hardware, things like that. And I'm probably going to work on building up a more like a things for sale page on there, I think. But, it's pretty simple, thekiltedwoodworker.com. And then also Instagram, thekiltedwoodworker.com. Or thekiltedwoodworker is Instagram. Apparently, it was too long for Twitter. So, at built in a kilt is my Twitter handle. But
That's interesting.
Yeah, thank you. But
I didn't know they had a terrible limit.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Because your handle goes against your used to. I don't think it does.
Well, used to, actually. And it doesn't mean as much now that it's been expanded twice as much.
Instagram has character limits on how much you can put in a post.
Really? Because I read some books on there.
I hit that all the time. Yes. In DMs and in posts. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, that's significant, though. Is it? I mean, it's hundreds of characters, right?
I
mean,
it is. And I still hit it.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's why the blog still exists, because you can just write stories.
Yeah. You know, one thing that Megan challenged me to do a long time ago, and it's something that I try to do with my blog posts, is I do try to keep them to 500 to 800 words. Mm-hmm. I try to do my own editing on there and keep it down as much as I can. But
Writing is like music in that it's about the notes you don't play.
It is, yes. Yeah. I think I've gotten pretty good over the years at editing and you know, I don't have any problem with looking at my writing and saying, you know what, I don't need this paragraph. Cut it out, you know, move on to the next thing and see what I can clean out here.
Yeah. So if folks are interested in the magazine, where can they find that at?
That's a great question. If you just go to Quirkusmagazine.com, I believe is the actual website. But if you want to order it, do you have it's actually a subscription type. mymagazinesub.co.uk/Quirkus is the website for that.
Exactly. But I think if you just search for the magazine, that's how I did it.
Yeah. Pops right up. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and right now you can get.
That's the name of the magazine is Quirkus, Q-U-E-R-Q-U-S.
Nope.
Q-U-E-R-C-U-S.
What did I say? Q-U-E-R-C-U-S. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
No, I can't read. So anyway.
And you can get it in digital or in paper. Yeah. So if you're in the U.S. and you don't want to pay the shipping, the £5.50 shipping for a paper copy, you can do a digital copy. And it's only, I think it's £4.50.
Mm-hmm.
That's British speak. I don't know what that means.
£4.50.
I don't know.
£5.50 converts to whatever.
Yeah, no, yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. I know. I'm teasing. I actually know the conversion to it.
I know. I don't even know that.
So with that, Diami, where can folks find you?
At my bench.
Mm-hmm. At your bench. Okay, fantastic.
Or you can find me on Twitter at Diami Plotky.
When you can.
You can.
Kyle, how about you?
Well, you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that, Sean, where can folks find you?
Yeah, I'm SeanW78 on most social medias, including all of those that matter to you. And that just about wraps up the show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. Then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. While you're there, please leave us a review.
Thank you for listening. You go to our website, follow us on Twitter at @MWA_national, on Instagram at @MWA_podcast, or what I think you should do is you should call Vic and get Robin Lee's phone number, cell number preferably, and call Robin and say, like, Rob, what is it that you bought 50,000 of and you've sold 9 of and you really need to get rid of, and work a deal out with him, and then you could get them and put them on a lathe and re-thread them so they're backwards threaded and then fill them with oil, and the woodworkers are going to go crazy and you can retire on that. So that's what you should do.
I will look into that.